Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. A show polluted with conductors and composers today. We have Mark Adamo, who composed the San Francisco Opera for the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. He'll be here with Nathan Gunn. Also, actors from the Aurora Theater will be here to talk about their season closer, This Is How It Goes. Composer Eleanor Aversa with music director Megan Solomon will also discuss the upcoming San Francisco Choral Artists Concerts, which will feature the world premiere of works not only by Aversa, but by Josh Horowitz and Mark Wings. Stay with us. San Francisco Opera continues its commitment to bringing thought-provoking modern opera to its audiences. In the tradition of Dead Man Walking, Death of Klinghoffer, and Heart of a Soldier, among others, comes the world premiere of Mark Adamo's The Gospel of Mary Magdalene, which is based on the canonical and Gnostic Gospels. Usually such an undertaking is a co-production with some other prominent opera company to help offset the tremendous expenses involved in birthing a major work. But opera director David Gockley was unable to get anyone to commit, possibly due to the subject matter or finances for other reasons. But he went boldly ahead to be the sole commissioning company to bring this incredible work to light. I'm very pleased to welcome American composer Mark Adamo, whose opera Little Women received its world premiere at the Houston Grand Opera, and whose recent works include a chamber piece for Thomas Hampson and the Jupiter String Quartet, and a double flute concerto for James Galway that, as a flutist, I'm very personally excited about, and baritone Nathan Gunn, who made his San Francisco Opera debut as Figaro in the 2003 production of Barber of Seville, was also heard in memorable roles here as Billy Budd and other roles in The Magic Flute as Papageno. Nathan has the non-titular but supreme leading role of Yeshua, or Jesus, in this opera. Gentlemen, shalom, and welcome to KLW.
Hello, thank you.
Glad to be here.
I need to start with an apology, as I already know we're not going to have nearly enough time to delve into this opera as much as I'd like to. So I'm going to invite you back right now. Accept?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, good.
Done.
Especially after seeing part of the rehearsal yesterday. It's going to be a spectacular production.
Thank you.
Mark, I'd like to start with the genesis of this project, which wasn't the book of Genesis after all, but the canonical and Gnostic Gospels. For those unfamiliar with those texts and those discoveries, really, can you provide us just a brief background?
Sure. In 1945, there was discovered in the upper Nile town of Nag Hammadi in Egypt a number of urns which contained scrolls, which contained versions of the story of Jesus and his followers that dated from about the same period as those that were accepted into the canonical New Testament, but told very, very different versions of that story, particularly dealing with the character of Mary Magdalene and with Peter. Some of them were called Gnostic because they dealt with a kind of spirituality that really stressed internal revelation more than external rule-making and rule-following. But the thing that was extraordinary about the discovery was to realize how the multiplicity of early traditions around the story of Jesus, that even in the canonical Gospels there are significant disagreements, but these really opened the range of interpretations substantially.
It's from these texts that we learned that Mary Magdalene was Jesus's koinonos,
precisely,
or companion,
yes.
as it's translated from. Is it translated from the Greek or from the Aramaic?
Well, that's the Greek, although the texts were probably written in other languages and then translated into Greek later. So what you really got was a series of psychological insights, or at least suggestions about about how the personal politics of Jesus' movement may have played out in his own place and time. And that combined with other biblical scholarship into the canon. I mean, most provocatively, for example, the illegitimacy tradition that Jane Schauberg argued in her Book of the 80s, that may have been the tradition to which the later virgin birth narratives were a response, gave me the idea that it was possible maybe to come up with a version of this story that gave you a credibly human original of something that we only knew from later and more miraculous adaptations.
Now, did this research arise out of your own faith questions? What faith tradition do you come from, if any?
Well, I was raised Roman Catholic.
I'm sorry to hear. I'm recovering Catholic myself.
The seekers in the opening moments of this show really speak not only to me, but I think to a lot of people, as you have just indicated, because it's a, as they say, they love it too much to leave, but they have too many difficulties with it to stay. And so what do you do with that? And one of the things that was exciting about learning that these texts existed was to say, gosh, maybe there's another way into this story, which substitutes for all these miraculous elaborations, female characters that are as human and as eloquent as the men, and a whole narrative which shows people making momentous decisions by moral intuition and the light they have to see by. So I thought that was an extraordinary idea for an opera.
Sure. As you're discovering these texts and rediscovering these discoveries, I'm wondering if you weren't, I don't know if the angry is the right word, but had problems with the Catholic Church saying, hey, why wasn't I told about this?
Well, I think, to put it elegantly, I mean, any given religious tradition tends to be attached to the text that it has hallowed. That a decision has been made about which versions it's going to put forth. And so, predictably, there's a certain amount of protectiveness about that. Sure. But I am writing really as a secular artist informed by Catholicism. And I guess the biggest question here is, are we at a point culturally where we can take the story of Jesus and his followers as literature rather than as dogma? I mean, in a certain way, when we stage Hamlet, we don't engage in vigorous arguments about the state of the Danish monarchy in the Middle Ages, do you know? And yet we can look at Hamlet as an inspired human document that still has something to say about the way we live now. And when you consider that there's so much to be drawn literarily from these historical fragments, and that there is a way of revisiting this story in such a way that would not only be dramatically interesting, but potentially healing to those people who felt alienated from the versions that were licensed by this or that tradition, I would go see that opera, but no one had written it before now.
All right. Well, now you've spent 6 years at least of research on this and must have come up with too much information. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you confine the work to a two-act opera rather than a ring cycle.
Well, there were a couple of rules up front, because there's such a trove of documentation or mythography about these characters, I thought I'm only going to limit myself to those texts from the first and second century. So all of the stuff that happened later, that the medieval myths of Mary Magdalene being set adrift in a barge and landing in Marseille and giving birth to the French royal family, picturesque as that is, that really didn't have anything to do with what I was going to do.
Was this self-editing on your part, or did you have someone that was saying, not so much the scene?
Oh, no, I just thought that that would be the more interesting story. I thought that if the texts existed from which you could construct this, and I made the decision very early on that there would be no miraculous explanation for something that could be explained by human psychology or biology, and that we would confine oneself only to those non-canonical texts that came from the same area of the country and from about the same provenance as the canonical Gospels, that would be an extraordinary thing to do. And that, so it limited itself in a nice way.
Before we get into the actual plot and then setting up the opera, I want to introduce Nathan Gunn to the conversation. Nathan, thank
Hello.
You for staying by here.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, I have to ask you, you've also been a champion of new music, but with an international opera schedule as you must have, how do you map out the proper time to bring a new role to life? I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, in November 2015, I'll be doing Figaro at La Scala and Billy Budd the next month in London. But something like this, must take an awful lot of time.
It takes a lot of time, but in a way, it's these sorts of projects that keep me doing the Figaro's and that I could just continually do. And
well, the Figaro's must provide the paycheck.
They're a great paycheck. They absolutely are. But I'm extremely committed to new pieces. I think it's very important that people working at my level do them and try to present them in their best light. And so I do a lot of it. And luckily, I'm a pretty quick study, but I'm inspired by the process because I get to actually come at it with somewhat of a blank slate, as much as I can, considering that there are specific rhythms and pitches and things.
Sure,
talk us
through your learning process of something brand new.
Well, I try to start as early as possible. With this, Mark had asked me about it before he had actually written the libretto or any of the music. And so what I liked you can only go so far, with kind of an overview of what's going to happen. But the thing that intrigued me was presenting this story and these characters that everybody knows in a way that is very human, and in a way where we don't know what's going to happen in the end. So I start early on, then I try as much as possible to be involved in the process while not getting in the way. And and with any new piece that whether it's being written, now, or whether it's a new piece I'm just unfamiliar with, I look at the text. I look and see if this is something that I can commit myself to, and if it's something I can relate to. And it's kind of weird saying I can relate to Jesus, but in this particular setting of it, where I'm not actually reading scripture, I'm not presenting myself as as a character, sort of as somebody who's reading it like you get in an oratorio. This is actually a human being having to make a very difficult decision and not knowing exactly why or whether he should, or being drawn by these sort of worldly things that we are all drawn by. For him, it's, do I do what I know that I'm supposed to do, that I know I have to do, even though I've found my soulmate? What if I prefer to have a family? What is it worth, giving up?
Mark Adamo, did you have Nathan Gunn in mind from the start?
He was talked about very early, and I was delighted that he came on board. Absolutely. It was really a great privilege that the company and I started these conversations so early, because the only thing that I knew about Nathan personally was that, if I can say this, your faith tradition had been very important to him. My only doubt was, gosh, it's not the version of the story he's accustomed to, and will he come on his journey?
I took a picture of the wedding outfit, and I texted it to my mom. I'm like, "Hey, mom, here's my wedding clothes. It's Jesus." She's like, "Jesus did not get married." Exactly. Like he is right now.
So that was really what had happened when the company had said, "Well, Nathan, have you thought of Nathan?" I said, "Nathan, Will he talk to me about this piece?" And I hadn't known that, and I said, "Yes, I'd love to meet with him." But I truly thought Snowball in Hell. And then we had this great meeting in New York, and we were talking about Thomas Merton, and you would,
because
I had not known how much of this literature that Nathan knew independently. So we had this great 3-hour discussion, and then Nathan texted me and said, "Okay, I'm on board." Yeah. So it was thrilling.
What, if you want to share, what religion background are you coming from?
Episcopalian. Anglican, yeah.
And discovering this work with Mark as it's unfolding, did that contribute to your exploration of your own faith?
Well, I actually always have. I've always been interested in, these Nag Hammadi scriptures and the other Gnostic gospels, and as well as the canonic things and other kinds of writings, the whole Midrash tradition and why we haven't adopted it in Christianity and stuff like that. And so for me, especially, it's not what I would call oratorio. It's not a religious piece. And I've talked to Mark about this before. Near the end of the first act, I don't know how much I can give away. After Mary Magdalene and Yeshua
have an intimate conversation.
What I'm hoping is that, and I think we do this, we get there most of the time, and I'm hoping if we do our jobs correctly, we'll get there. You'll forget that you're talking about Jesus Christ and
yes.
Mary Magdalene. You start to see them as human beings rather than ideas.
Yeah, and this is a tribute to what Nathan and Sasha Cook, who is the mezzo-soprano singing Mary Magdalene, are doing. Really, obviously, we're going to enter with this iconography in our heads. In a certain way, the opera is a great counterpoint to a melody we come in singing. But by the middle of the show, and this is entirely due to the interpretation, you know, acting and musical, it's scenes from a marriage. You know, you're just you're in the dilemma of these particular people.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting intellectual journey to be there, and you become emotionally attached to the characters, and sort of, you know, kind of like Billy Budd, you don't want him to die, but then what happens, you know? And then, but the other side of us says, well, we know how this ends, but if we were there at the time, would we have supported that decision or not?
Yeah, it makes me think that if the second coming or the first coming, depending on how you interpret your religious
part
background.
Part two.
There you go.
See, and you thought this couldn't be a ring cycle.
I think the first paper that's going to cover it is going to be the National Enquirer. And then,
very well made. Well, you know, it's curious because the most politically radical thing, although, frankly, I think that even to call it controversial is to disserve the sophistication of an audience in 2013. For every one person who has raised an eyebrow about approaching this material in this way, there have been 100 people who have been eager to see any stage take on this material. But just to go back, to call it, because this is a somewhat politically surprising thing to do, and yet it is also the most basic thing that you do as an operatic dramatist, which is to take people who exist in two dimensions and to round them out. Through kind of an emotional exploration of how they track through their lives, not only guided by their ideas, but by their bodies and by their feelings, and to give that the extra dimension that only music can provide.
Now, with so much scholarship involved in the creation of the work, it's almost an insurance policy against controversy. Your libretto alone contains some 116 footnotes that refer to specific passages and sources. But did you receive the official seal of condemnation from the Catholic Archdiocese, or maybe...
Well, I mean, knowing my tradition pretty well, They are the one denomination with whom we would not had a great deal of conversation. We were going to have a Catholic radio interview, and then that was delicately postponed. Which I understand. You know, I mean, this. I mean, I understand. I don't necessarily sympathize, but I do understand that my tradition tends to be very succinct about what it considers. Orthodox, what it considers, you know, to be true, and therefore it's not going to give a lot of oxygen to talking about things that might be true. That decision has been made. But the footnotes were really there simply to make sure that I knew what I was doing, and also to make sure that people knew that this was not a graffito scrawled across the New Testament. It was, if you will, to use a kind of Jewish term, it was a Talmud, if you will, on the Torah of the New Testament, a kind of commentary that results from not so much passively inheriting this story, but reading deeply into it and wrestling with its implications and offering another possibility of its interpretation.
Now, ultimately, this is an entertainment, opera
yes.
or otherwise, though, and artistic liberties
arias.
Must be taken.
There's even comedy.
Now, for the sake of the spectacle of it, these liberties must be taken. Now, where did these liberties stray from the scholarly research that came in?
Oh, gosh. Not very often. I mean, well, probably the better way of putting that is that there's a great deal that I invented, but I tried to invent it from implications that were in the text. For example, in Act 1, Scene 2, Yeshua's first big sermon scene, which is drawn from the canonical Gospels, the scene that might be the most startling to an audience is hiding in plain sight in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which is when Yeshua is preaching in front of a synagogue in Capernaum. The elders doubt his veracity. And he says, I paraphrase, that if you really were the people that you say you were, you would know I were speaking the truth. Mm-hmm. And the elders say, yes, but we, and this is in the Coptic equivalent of italic font, we were not born of fornication. At which point, his mother and brothers come in, meaning to rescue him, saying, forgive him, Rabbi, he is deranged. Other people in the crowd say, your mother and brothers are here. And Yeshua says, my mother and brothers, who are they? And flees. This is in the same Bible that we attend to on any given Sunday at the services of any given Christian denomination. Now, what I have invented is Mary Magdalene's presence that scene. And what I have invented is the dialogue between Mother Mary, who was called Miriam in this script, and Mary Magdalene. But it's answering a question that is posed by the scholarship, which is, after Yeshua leaves the scene, what might Mother Mary have thought, particularly if you consider the broad and deep presence of an illegitimacy tradition in this story, which is indicated even in this scene by having the elders say, isn't this Yeshua son of Mary, not, as would have been traditional at the time, son of Joseph, or son of Joseph, rather. Right. So that's the method. I mean, did I make up that monologue? Absolutely. Did it come from something? Absolutely as well.
So tell me, why did you call Nathan's character Yeshua instead of Jesus when you use Peter and Mary and the other Levi, more familiar characters?
What I was trying to do was indicate that the story was taking place before there was anything of what we would call a Christian church, or even a movement to establish such a thing. As far as we know historically, Jesus was not so much trying to form a new tradition as to reinvigorate and reexamine his own. And because Yeshua was the Aramaic original of the kind of Hellenic or Latinized Jesus, that seemed to be a little more appropriate. The problem is that Mary Magdalene doesn't have that alternate available to us. Miriam is a Hebraic alternate of Mary, so that allowed me both to distinguish that female character from Mary Magdalene, but neither Mary Magdalene nor Peter really had an equivalent that seemed to be as eloquent. So that was how that was decided.
So we have the premise of Yeshua as an illegitimate child, and Jesus and Mary Magdalene as husband and wife, or at least close companions. So you alluded earlier to seekers. Could you set the scene for us as the curtain opens? It begins in the score with what I've never heard before, a prolegomenon. Say that again.
Prolegomenon.
Many.
Which is a Greek term for not so much a prologue, but as a preliminary discussion about what you are about to see, which I thought was a little more appropriate. I have gotten something of a reputation in the company for elaborate, not to say precious, stage and or tempo directions. Hurtling, quarter equals 144. But anyway, what we see, and I thought this is very important to set up the emotional stakes of the piece, what we see is an archaeological dig in what is assumed to be the Holy Land. And you have five seekers, five disaffected moderns, who, as I mentioned earlier, are caught between throwing out, if you will, the baby Jesus with the bathwater of doctrine. That is to say that they love so much of what they have inherited from the tradition, but as moderns, as women who have taken the burden of the church's not always friendly doctrine towards women, as people who have sometimes made sexual decisions or found themselves in sexual categories that this tradition has no place for, they're wondering what they can, how they can, if you will, refresh or invigorate or revisit this tradition so that it is not simply a choice between being modern and loving that story. So it is their opening chorus that expresses their anguish, and then my conceit is that it is that anguish that, in a kind of surreal moment, calls in the chorus, which reveals the existence of the Nag Hammadi texts. And so the rest of the piece is a kind of triangle, if you will, between the seekers who have called forth the biblical characters, who walk through that story, sometimes in ways that are very familiar and sometimes in ways that are completely unfamiliar. And at that point, there's a little bit of dialogue between the seekers and the chorus as to where that's come from.
We don't have an excerpt from that very beginning, but we do have an excerpt of some of your music from the opera to give listeners just a sense of your musical style in this one instance. I believe it's setting up an aria which concludes before the aria starts.
Okay.
Let's hear a little bit of that now.
Thank you.
it's actually the interlude that happens right after Mary Magdalene and Yeshua realize that their relationship has crossed a certain threshold, and that leads into the conversation, which in many ways is the heart of the show, which is about the nature of desire and whether it belongs in a morally ambitious life, or as Mary Magdalene puts in her text, you know, I can't say I don't desire you and I won't try. Does that make me wrong? Does that make me less? As we strive for something higher, has desire no place? But that also is, that particular music is heard earlier in Mary Magdalene's initial aria, which is drawn from the Song of Songs, because in many ways, while her dramatic situations are drawn from the non-canonical as well as the canonical Gospels, musically, and this is supported by the texts, she is portrayed very much in the language of the Song of Songs, the Shulamite, who is the exalted lover in the Song of Songs. And there's a good deal of language in the Gospel of John that indicates that whoever wrote the Gospel of John was really presenting Mary Magdalene to a certain extent as that kind of avatar of divinely sanctioned erotic love. And so that kind of leads to another observation about the score, which is that it is extremely organized motivically. It's a lot of web, of vocal song, of melody that is kind of refracted through and gilded rather than driven by the orchestra.
So do you have particular leitmotifs in mind for characters or intervals that you only hear Yeshua sing?
Well, there are, I mean, sometimes Yeshua has motives that are only his, but sometimes, for example, there was a design motive, because Nathan alluded earlier to Yeshua's dilemma that he feels like he has an intuition that he is part of a design to which he feels accountable but can only dimly understand. In a way, a sense of his own divinity, which we get from the canonical Gospels, has been replaced in this reading by a sense of fate. But that motive is also shared by his mother, because the circumstances of his birth presented her with a moral dilemma not incomparable to Yeshua's scene on the Mount of Olives, his Gethsemane scene. So it seemed to make a great deal of musical sense to link those comparable emotional situations by music of comparable melodic character.
So how do you do, Nathan?
I think you did a really good job. Yeah. And it's, and what's interesting about what he's done with, because often you get, you know, like you said, a particular tune or a particular motive for one person or a setting. What's interesting about how Mark designed this was that you get a certain tune for a certain kind of thought or a certain sense of fate, like he was just saying. But when the different characters sing it, when it's played with the different characters' particular journey, it takes on a different meaning. And I think that's a very interesting thing for people because it personalizes it.
Hmm. As you both mentioned, hopefully this is an educational and an enlightening opportunity for everyone, maybe leaving the theater with more questions than answers, but egging us on to our own personal discoveries. I should also add that a number of ancillary educational activities have been going on throughout the Bay Area. San Francisco Opera has partnered with an array of cultural, religious, and educational institutions to present seminars and workshops with the opera's cast and creative teams. This morning there was an event in Sonoma. This Saturday there's a full-day workshop at Grace Cathedral exploring the Gnostic perspective on Mary Magdalene, learning some ancient spiritual practices at Grace Cathedral Saturday. More info on that and other events happening at sfopera.com. It's there you can also learn the full performance schedule, which begins with the premiere next Wednesday evening, not last night, as All Things Considered mentioned yesterday afternoon. I should also mention that my dear, dear colleague, Sarah Cahill, who subbed for me here on Open Air last week, thanks again, Sarah, will be offering the pre-opera talks for all of the performances. Well, after having Jesus on my program, I think my work is done here. I can't aim much higher than that. Mark Adamo, Nathan Gunn, I wish you a fantastic, thought-provoking run at San Francisco Opera and beyond.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks very much. It's been a delight.
Coming up, I'll be talking with folks from San Francisco Choral Artists and the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Stay with us. Thank you. Well, closing season 21 of the Aurora Theater is Neil LaBute's This Is How It Goes, a play for a trio of actors, triangulating in most senses of the word. And I'm pleased to welcome that very trio to KALW to talk about the play. We have Aldo Billingsley as Cody, Carrie Paff as the woman Belinda, and Gabe Marin as the man. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, what can you tell us about the playwright Neil LaBute? Enlighten me, please. This is Corey.
And the Neil LaBute is a playwright who a lot of people talk about his plays and saying that he is misogynistic or misanthropic, and in that sometimes he doesn't show the best men behaving the best way toward women. So, and yet his plays are so compelling. They're things you can't take your eyes off of. So, the first LaBute in the Bay Area, I believe, was in 2003, The Shape of Things, directed by Tom Ross, artistic director of the Aurora Theater. And they've done a number of his plays, and so we're glad to do this one, which is kind of an upper-level LaBute play.
That's Aldo Billingsley. He's playing Cody in This Is How It Goes, with some laughing commentary there by Gabe Marin. Is that sum things up, Gabe?
It does. Neil LaBute is a very provocative playwright and filmmaker, and he doesn't like to just do an ordinary story. You know, when you're going to see one of his works, that there's going to be a twist, that he's going to provoke you. He's going to dare you. He's going to tempt you. And this play, This Is How It Goes, certainly does that. It's a little bit of a noir. You know, it's got a lot of twists and turns to it. I think being Neil LaBute, he presents a story to you and then pulls the rug out three or four times in a significant way.
Carrie Paff, anything to add to that as the sole female character in this triangle?
Well, it's interesting because I think that LaBute has actually done a lot to earn his, you know, labeling as misanthropic and misogynistic over the years. But it's fascinating. This is my introduction to LaBute. I've never done any of his plays before. I just saw In the Company of Men for the first time during this rehearsal process, his film. But I find Belinda to be an incredibly well-written character. He seems to have a great deal of sympathy for her. She's complicated. She's funny. She's smart. She is a victim of some bad stuff going on in the man's world that she lives in, the men's world. I find her to be a real human being and not just like an idea of a woman. I actually really enjoy playing her.
Mm-hmm. A quote from the New York Times in 2004 from the Aurora website has LaBute saying, "I think I fall more straight down the line of humanist, and that means being fair to both sides. I'm not even very cynical. You may disagree after seeing this play. I'm just kind of suspicious of the way we deal with each other. I think that people are very driven by self-preservation and find it extremely difficult to live with other people and to maintain friendships and to be honest. If it's slightly easier to get away with something, then they'll give it a shot. A lot of the dynamics of what I discuss on paper are power relationships, the way people jostle with each other to come out on top," from a 2004 interview with LaBute. So you have some interesting situations going on in this play.
Yeah, and I think I actually have, my character has halfway through the play a really interesting monologue about her motivations for why she married Cody, this African-American, one African-American guy in the town who's this rich black guy. He's the track star. He's the real big, you know, big man on campus.
And I should mention that carries the blonde cheerleader type.
That's right. Okay. That's what I'm doing in this. Yeah. But there's an incredible monologue where she tells the man who's come into town, the white guy who's just arrived, who is also a high school friend, about what's going on, you know, with her and her marriage. And she's in a great crisis in her life. Her marriage is in crisis. She's having trouble with her children. She's feeling that her life has not been very well lived. And she reveals to him why she married him, and that there's this real kind of shallowness in her that she's very embarrassed of, but she's willing to be honest about it with him to try to start her life over again.
So the gentleman that comes to live above the garage acts as counselor and
yes, and
inserts
more.
Himself and more as the triangle begins. Now, you three have worked together at the Aurora for the world premiere of Alison Moore's Collapse back in 2011, as I understand. Now, was that a good trial run for this, getting to know each other's styles and quirks, so to speak?
Yeah. There was actually four of us. Amy Resnick was in that play as well. She's not in this one. This is a three-hander. And yes, because
explain a minute for what a three-hander means.
There are three actors here, and there were four actors.
And they only have one hand each?
And exactly.
Yeah, I'm not sure why we say that, but you say a two-hander, a three-hander. Yeah, two-hander. Just like kind of cowboy talk for actors.
Actors as hands. So
hired hands.
Hired hands.
That
is why. Oh, my gosh.
Script hands is what we are. We wrangle a script. And so
that's true. Very, very good.
We do.
Let's go on with this illusion. Come on. Contribute something.
How much more can we do?
Let's beat it.
All right. So I'm sorry. That was rude of me to interrupt.
No. It's all right. Is the horse dead yet, or shall we still beat it? well done. So we got to work on a world premiere, and that was really well done and pretty much almost finished. But there were some moments where we had to say very late in the process, this scene is gone. This is going to shift here, those sorts of things. And there was a lot of adaptation that had to happen in the midst of the process.
Very late in the process. Yeah, like we had audiences coming in that night, and we're taking scenes out and putting new scenes in.
Yeah, it's part of the process of working on a new play. That's exciting. You will do a show one night and realize that there's a scene that just doesn't work, and there was that. I remember what was scene five or what have you, and I went out there by myself, and it was brutal. And so we did it a couple times, then we realized, okay, that scene isn't really necessary.
So does that mean you just have to wrestle with the script, or do you have to go back to the playwright and say, hey, can we do something different here to go off script? Or
theater's a collaboration, and so you have a director and a playwright and actors who are all pulling the same direction. And when you know that it's not the acting, and we've directed it as best we can, you have to go to the playwright and say, do we need this? Is it necessary? If this is fat, can we cut it away and make the play a little bit more lean? And we did. We had a playwright who was very flexible, and we were able to do that. And now we have this script, and we have a director who knows his labute, who knows his space, and having seen us work and worked with these two before, it's been really a great process trying to shape this piece and bring this one to the Berkeley stage.
That's Aldo Billingsley. He's starring as Cody in Neil LaBute's play, This Is How It Goes. Also in studio, Carrie Paff as Belinda, the woman, and Gabe Marin as the man. Now, Gabe, I'm sorry you don't have a name.
Oh,
or
I know.
Do you later in the play? You're just Bill.
No, I'm just man. Uh-huh. I'm just man. And, I've played with giving myself, just my own personal notion. I've given myself a name several times, and that's changed. But, Neil does not give me a name, unfortunately.
And the question is does that make him every man or just one particular man? And, that's another question for the audience to answer. There's a lot about this play that's really great, but that we can't talk about, and we can't reveal.
Giving away the baby with the backwash.
There's some really terrific twists that happen in this piece. There's probably about two to three major reversals that happen, and that I think the audience is really going to love. And we don't want to deprive them of those wonderful epiphanies when they happen.
But it's a wonderful mixture of Hitchcock films and Jane Austen and Thomas Hardy and
Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
References to Angela Davis.
Angela Davis. Amy Mann songs and lyrics are like folded in there.
Edward Albee. References to Virginia Woolf.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a play written for an intelligent literary audience. But it's also a play
in Berkeley.
Who would think?
Thunk it.
But it comes. Exactly. But it comes from the gut. The play comes
exactly.
from the gut. 100%.
Yeah.
Have either any one of the three of you done any works by LaBute in the past?
I have not.
No, I have not, and I've really looked forward to to working on this piece. I am really interested to see. We have our first audience on Friday, and
that's tomorrow.
I cannot wait. I know. I cannot wait to hear the reactions from the audience at certain points in this play.
Because
it will be audible.
There will be audible gasp.
There will be some nervous laughter. There will be some uncontrollable giggles, and then there will be some wonderful silences.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully no tomatoes.
Well, on that note, I want to thank Aldo Billingsley as Cody, Carrie Paff as Belinda, the woman, and Gabe Marin for coming in today. The show This Is How It Goes, being directed by Tom Ross, the artistic director of the Aurora Theater, will be running through, starts tomorrow, runs through July 21st, and closes the company's 21st season. Tickets and information at auroratheater.org. I also want to mention my sympathies for the company's loss of Barbara Oliver recently.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
She was on with me here on Open Air this past fall, and it seems like there was a lot more to come from that grand dame.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure she'll be with you tomorrow night as well.
Indeed.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking some time for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's a couple of unrehearsed klezmer excerpts, which introduce me to our final segment of the show. It's the San Francisco Choral Artists. A couple of the artists join me here, including Megan Solomon, the artistic director, and Eleanor Aversa, who's got a piece involved with the upcoming concerts. Welcome to Open Air and this circus of people today.
Thank you. It's a really delight to be here.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
So tell me a little bit about this concert that's coming up. It's called Omens, Dreams, and Curses, the 15th, the 16th, and the 23rd. We'll get more in detail about the venues in a moment. But how did this theme come together, Megan?
Well, last year, last March, we did a collaboration with Ferretsky Pass. This is a wonderful klezmer trio located here in the Bay Area, recently moved about a year, 2 years ago from the East Coast.
And I apologize in advance for giving those rather abrupt little excerpts there. We'll hear
more
in a minute.
No, that's fine. That's fine. They're spectacular players and with a really wide range of styles. People tend to think of klezmer music as being the sort of traditional clarinet, piano, violin, and songs that they're familiar with. This group is spectacular because they do a much wider range of repertoire, including some very interesting and very unusual folk music from all parts of Eastern Europe. We did a collaboration with them last year and had such a great time that basically as we were leaving stage, we said we've got to meet again and do something else. So we got together the next week and talked about what we wanted to do this year. Ferretsky Pass, meanwhile, was starting a project on Jewish superstitions, and they thought this would be an interesting topic for us to explore together. And that is how Omens, Dreams, and Curses came about, is they're just some of the superstitions that are part of the Jewish tradition are going to be involved in our concert. So some of it will be Ferretsky Pass playing by themselves. Some of it will be San Francisco choral artists singing by ourselves, and some of it will be joint works.
And one of those joint works is by Eleanor Aversa, who joins artistic director Megan Solomon here in studio. Among Eleanor's honors are national awards such as the Northridge Composition Prize, first prize in the San Francisco Choral Artists New Voices Competition for her work Eyes Open, and fellowships from the McDowell Colony, the iPark Foundation, and the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. Eleanor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, among your travels includes a degree in Russian language and literature from Princeton, and you lived for a while in Moscow from 2002 to 2005. What sort of music were you exposed there, and did this influence this particular piece we'll hear this weekend?
I was exposed to a great deal of music. I, of course, love going to the Bolshoi Theater and just hearing this wonderful ballet tradition. And even on the subway, you just would not believe the musicality of even street musicians there. It was really something fantastic. This klezmer tradition was not something, though, that I'd really heard much of. And I think there are really two ways for a composer to sort of get in the spirit of a piece. And one of them is sort of the conscious way. And I did do some taking out my good old Harvard Music Dictionary and what exactly are the scales used in klezmer, and sort of copying them out and tapping that up in my corkboard. But the other is a sort of unconscious, just getting into the feel of it. And that meant, you know, listening, of course, to the Wretzky Pass clips that were on their website, and just going to Pandora and getting an earful of this klezmer sound, and using sort of both the unconscious and the conscious to sort of inform my introduction to writing in that style.
And how the piece that's going to be performed, how long is it?
I decided to do two short pieces, two humorous pieces, both about a minute and a half or so. I thought that would be sort of a nice balance after doing a lot of serious work to balance that out with something lighter for this time around.
Megan Solomon, you have a fine tradition of supporting local composers, contemporary composers, as part of San Francisco Choral Artists. How did that come about? How did the organization come to be?
Well, the organization started close to 30 years ago. They were actually the paid choir at St. Mary's Cathedral in San Francisco. And one Sunday, apparently, there was a new priest and a change in the kind of music that they wanted to have there at the cathedral. And the paid singers were fired. And they loved singing together so much that they said, let's become independent. So they suddenly, within a week, became an independent organization. And that director at St. Mary's was their conductor for 5 years. And then Claire Giovannetti, who was one of the singers, took over for 5 years. And then I came onto the scene. So I've been with them for 18. They had always been involved with contemporary music, particularly because Ralph Hooper, the founder of the group, is a composer as well. But it seemed like there was so much of a need to have local composers have an outlet, have a voice. And I feel that it's so important for listeners to be aware of that composers are not all dead white guys, that there are living composers, that there are living composers in their midst. And so we started focusing more and more on that. And in my 18 years now, I've lost count a little, but I think we're close to 200 world premieres.
Wow, fantastic.
And we're very proud of that. And so I feel it's really important to support the local composers, but also for audiences to know that writing music, hearing live music, meeting composers is a normal thing. It's not a weird thing.
Well, let's hear some of the fantastic work you've been doing with San Francisco Choral Artists. From a live CD, you have a compilation of local composers called Music Among Friends. We're going to hear The Dance by Russell Burnham, San Francisco Choral Artists. And then more with Megan Solomon and composer Eleanor Aversa.
Thank you.
The beautiful sound of the San Francisco Choral Artists under its music director, Megan Solomon. That's from a CD called Music Among Friends, and we heard Russell Burnham's The Dance. That CD has some 22 works that were premiered and, I guess, commissioned by the San Francisco Choral Artists. Is
mostly
that right, Megan?
Premiered and commissioned by us.
Very nice, but nonetheless, contemporary music by this great group. Does the core ensemble remain at a fixed number, or are things flexible throughout?
The number stays the same, though the personnel changes. We've been at 24 for most of our time, so, you know, 6 sopranos, 6 altos, 5 tenors, and 7 basses.
Mm-hmm. Eleanor, you have a piece that's coming up as part of these performances Saturday the 15th, this Saturday at St. Gregory of Nyssa Episcopal Church in San Francisco, mm-hmm. Sunday the 16th, and then a week from Sunday. But you also contributed to a March concert of the San Francisco Choral Artists. Tell us about this piece we're going to hear just a little bit of.
Sure. This was a great pleasure. The theme of the concert was historical women, voices of women. And for many years, I'd been intrigued by the story of Rosalind Franklin and her X-ray diffraction studies, which really paved the way for Watson and Crick understanding the helical structure of DNA. And I was very fortunate. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew I wanted to use this tech somehow. So I wrote to Nature, to the permissions, and I was really pleased. Within just a day, they wrote back and they said, sure, we grant you artistic rights to use this text. So then the question became, okay, how do I set the scientific article to music and make it actually singable? So I chose a few portions from that, and there was a sort of a rhythm to some of the text that was there, and I did set that to music, and it was such a joy to have it performed and have it performed so well. The singers, it's one thing to hear a CD of the group, but to actually see them live and see the expression on the singers' faces really adds a lot. You can tell that they understand the story behind it.
Here is Eleanor of Versus, probably helical. Excerpt from Eleanor of Versus, probably helical, heard this March as part of the San Francisco Choral Artists concert. A work of Eleanor's will be premiered for this coming weekend's concerts of the San Francisco Choral Artists. Megan Solomon, tell us a little bit about the other composer involved in this concert.
We actually will have two other composers involved. The Choral Artists for several years have had a program called Composers in Residence, probably for about 15 years now. And our composer in residence for this year has been Mark Wingus, who's well known in the Bay Area, has worked a great deal with Volti and the Piedmont Children's Choir. He's also a fine organist. So he has a wonderful piece on this program called Scherzo Diabolique. It has no text, but it is a lot of syllables and sounds. It moves like the wind, and it's very rhythmic and varying. Eleanor is our composer not in residence for this season, and so this will be her swan song as well. Actually, she's doing two pieces on this program, one called Gesundheit and the other called Knock on Wood, and I think the audience is going to figure out how that fits into our superstitions plan. But of course, Josh Horowitz, who is one of the members of Oretzky Pass, has also several compositions on this program, and they are part of the Oretzky Pass's ongoing project of called Lilith the Night Demon. These are excerpts from that project, which we hope to collaborate and perform together next season.
Very nice. The concerts, once again, are the program theme, Omens, Dreams, and Curses, this Saturday at St. Gregory of Nyssa Episcopal Church in San Francisco, Sunday at Congregation Beth Jacob in Redwood City, and then a week from Sunday at the Temple Sinai. Where is the Temple Sinai?
In Oakland.
In Oakland as well. Well, I thank you both for spending a little time with us today.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Of course.
Sure, thank you.
And more information about the San Francisco Choral Artists at their website, sfca.org. It's there that you can perhaps purchase the Music Among Friends CD, as well as a wonderful Christmas CD they have, sfca.org. In fact, we're going out with Music of a Friend, David Conte, who is featured on that Music Among Friends CD. Here's a portion of Charm Me Asleep by David Conte. A brief thanks to producer Neil Swinkles for assistance with this week's show. And in his absence, Ashley Ann Krigbaum and Annette Bistrup for acting as ushers and coffee fetchers, among other tasks. And another shout-out to Sarah Cahill for subbing for me last week. And again, Sarah will be presenting the pre-concert talks for the world premiere performances of the San Francisco Opera's productions of The Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the new work by Mark Adamo. Be sure to catch that. I'm David Latulippe. Thanks for listening to Open Air this week.